Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by Bruce Burnworth. He is a retired civil engineer. He was featured in a Wall Street Journal article back in December 2020, making a Tesla option play that eventually turned into millions. He's using his newfound wealth to try to make the world a better place. And throughout the years, the past few years, he's stuck with Tesla. I wanted to invite him on my show, kind of hear his story, get his thoughts on Tesla and what's going on. How's it going, Bruce? How are you doing?
Hey, it's going great. Glad to be on.
Awesome. Thanks for joining. Yeah. So I've been following your Twitter and kind of your story for quite a while. And it seems like, you know, on the spectrum of Tesla investors, you're definitely on the side of taking a lot of risk. And part of your story is you started with, you know, Tesla options back in 2019, and you still hold a good amount of Tesla options. I'm curious, what is it kind of with in the spectrum of being kind of more on the extreme kind of more riskier side, what led up to that? Like, what's your perspective on risk? And why don't you just hold just purely Tesla stock? I know most of your holding actually is in Tesla stock now, but what's the fascination with options and how did that come about?
Yeah, so in 2017, I read an article by Tony Seba. And what he talked about was how the future was going to be electric vehicles and full self-driving, and that was going to change so much. So I read that article, was thinking about it, and I saw that, hey, within 10 years, it's going to be hard to buy an ICE vehicle. It's just going to be all electric within 10 years. And that was 2017. So the 2027 is the kind of the date that I picked out of the air kind of when I read that article. And then in 2018, I bought a Tesla Model 3 and have been enjoying that. And then in 2019, after Tesla had finished up with the production hill and the Model 3 was in production and going well, and I said, okay, now it's time to invest. And, you know, the Cybertruck was coming up and the Model Y was coming. So there were a lot of things that were coming up, and I thought, okay, this is great. And I was so convinced at that point in time that I said, yeah, this is ridiculous to do just normal stock because this stock's going to go up so high. I can take advantage of it. I'd done options previously on Micron and Intel, and I was able to take $100,000 and make it into $1 million, and then it went to zero. And so I learned a lot from that experience and what to do, what not to do. And so this time around, what I did was I put just, I think it was 90% into what I felt were conservative options that were, you know, far out and close to the money. And then I put 10% into options that were 3 to 6 months out and were way out of the money. And it turns out that those 3 to 6 month options that were way out of the money ended up paying off very well. I had one set of options that I bought for $23,000 that turned into $1.8 million in 8 months. The rest of it was less than that, but it also did well. So basically, it was my conviction that Tesla was the place to invest and they were going to do a great job and it was the future and they were going to be leading that future. And so that's why I went all in with options.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely fascinating. Like, I remember back in the day, like 2012, 2013, it was another kind of previous kind of time where the stock was kind of lulling for a few years before that. And it was this massive just like spike of, I think it did a 6X or 7X within, you know, several months. And people with options just made out like crazy. And 2019, leading in 2022, was another one of these opportunities. The stock had languished for several years. People were just so down on the stock. I'm curious. It's interesting here. You got a 2018 Model 3. What month do you remember in 2018 did you get that?
That was September okay. of 2018.
And were you following Tesla before that as well?
I was kind of following it. I was more following the trend and the how electric vehicles were going to be increasing and increasing. And, you know, and there wasn't much actually going on in the press about electric vehicles up until 2019. It was pretty slow. And I could see that electric vehicles were the future and it was going to happen. It was going to happen faster than most people thought. And it kind of led me to start investing in 2019.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder what would have happened if you had gotten the Chevy Bolt instead of the Tesla Model 3. Would you have invested in Tesla?
I had a friend that got a Chevy Bolt and, you know, it just wasn't the same. go very fast, and it was this kind of, I don't know, I didn't like the way it looked, and yeah.
Definitely. First disclaimer on this is, we'll be talking about, Tesla stock options, the future of Tesla. All of this obviously is not investment advice. Everyone, has their own responsibility. We'll also talk about actually some risks of options, because I think once you've, been exposed and you've done options, you realize it's not this pie in the sky, like happy, all everything works out thing, a lot of times, actually most of the times, it doesn't work out. Let's go back, actually. Let's actually talk about a few things present right now. This macro environment, we've got war, we've got, inflation, we've got possible recession, we've got all this crazy stuff going on. With your Tesla holdings, do you care about the macro environment at all? Or, does it worry you? Does it concern you? Or do you just kind of shut it off?
Well, I have two different perspectives. One perspective is the long-term perspective, which is none of this stuff matters with Tesla. Tesla is going to go ahead, and they're going to expand, and they're going to do great. It's not going to be an issue. So that's my long-term perspective. Then there's a perspective associated with the options that I have and the margins that I have. And there I have to watch more carefully what's happening on the macro, because the macro definitely affects the short-term prices associated with Tesla. And so I watch that carefully. And it's interesting. The main thing I watch is the QQQ, and that gives a good indication of what's happening in the market. And Tesla tends to follow that pretty closely. Although when the QQQ goes up, Tesla goes up a lot more. And when the QQQ goes down, then Tesla goes down a lot more. So I look for times, and I try to understand why Tesla is not matching the curve of QQQ. For example, this last week and a half, the QQQ was going up, but Tesla was going up like twice as much or three times as much as the QQQ. So that to me is a good sign of the strength associated with Tesla in the short term. And I think that'll continue to happen. As long as the market generally goes up, macro generally goes up, then Tesla will go way up.
So, like, looking out in the next 6 months or so, what are kind of your projections, or how are you feeling about the next 6 months? Are you relatively optimistic? Are you cautious, like, about the macro environment and the markets in general?
Yeah, the macro environment is hard to predict, as everybody knows. Who knows, when a war might break out, or when some inflation thing might pop up, or when something else might come up. Who knows what that something else might be? So it's kind of hard to predict, and I try to be prepared, and I have, like alternative plans of what happens if the macro environment goes down and the Tesla stock goes down temporarily. I'm prepared for that and ready to address it.
Got it. What I'm curious if, I guess, you're saying if it goes down, what if Tesla stock goes down? Do you have some scenarios in your head where if it goes down a lot, what you would do? What's your plan of action? Because, like, for me personally, I kind of like, I don't have a complicated, holdings. Most, like, almost everything is just stock. And so whether it goes up or down, I'm kind of like, in a similar position. There might be times where if it goes down like crazy amount, then I'll be tempted to shift some into, some leverage or something. But I'm curious, because you do have some existing leverage, what if Tesla stock goes down significantly? Or even this past, recent, couple months, has gone down, and it's rebounded recently. But, like, what was your kind of strategy and approach to handle, a decreasing Tesla stock
So,
price?
a couple of things. One going back actually to 2020, looking at that drop that happened at that point in time. What I did there, I was all in options. I didn't have any stock. It was just all options. Most of them were long-term options that were in the money at that point in time. And I said, this is ridiculous, because of the coronavirus, Tesla stock is going down. That just doesn't make any sense, because Tesla isn't impacted by this. And matter of fact, they're probably better off because of it long term. And so what I ended up doing at that point in time was I sold my house, my home, and I sold it below market price, because I wanted to be able to invest it in Tesla, and I knew it would go way up as soon as I invested it in Tesla. And so I was able to do that and came out really on the positive side. So that's one example. Another example is, like, last summer, last spring, summer, the stock was down. And I looked at it and said, at that point in time, I was like 80%+ in stock because I'd exercised my options into stock and had borrowed on margin in order to exercise my stock, my options into stock. So there I was dealing with option calls and or not option calls, margin calls, and had to come up with a way to cover those margin calls. And in the process of covering those margin calls, I discovered that if I sold stock in order to cover those margin calls, I would only get 40 cents for every dollar of stock that I sold because it was on margin. And I'd have to sell like practically all my stock just to cover the margin, which was absolutely ridiculous. And so what I looked into it more and found that I could sell covered calls against the stock and hold the stock and then buy back the covered calls once the stock went back up. So I was able to last summer, and I did that more this last fall. Well, last fall was good, but in the last couple of months now, I was able to sell covered calls in order to address my margin calls. And then as soon as the stock went back up, I was able to buy back the covered calls, and my stock was in place. The other problem I had was that the Tesla stock that I had is like 97% profit. And so there's a lot of capital gains that I have to pay. And now that's reduced because it's long-term capital gains. It's also reduced because I moved out of California and moved to Nevada. So both of those things helped to reduce that. But when it first happened, like when that $23,000 went to $1.8 million, if I just sold that, I would have paid over more than 60% of it to taxes. And so I was able to avoid that by exercising it into the stock.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Back in the day, I did, some kind of long dated option calls back in 2013. And yeah, by the time they, were coming to expiry in 2014, 2015, when I looked at the tax situation, I'm like, man, it works out better, at least in my situation that time, just to exercise as much as I could.
Right.
And even to hold some on margin at the time. Curious, with your strategy to buy covered calls, like you're facing a margin call, and instead of selling stock, you buy or you sell covered calls, right? So I'm guessing you're selling kind of long dated, perhaps cover calls. Are these out of the money cover calls? And how are you deciding on the strike there?
Yeah. So what I ended up doing was selling covered calls that were out in 2024, and they were $1,200 covered calls. And the reason I kind of focused in on that was because those did not fluctuate as much as the nearer term call options. And so they were kind of somewhat stable, and the price would go up and they'd go up a little bit, but not like the short-term covered call or short-term margin or calls options that would dramatically swing one way or the other. So I felt I could sell them, get the money cut to address the margin call, and then I could buy them back later at a higher price, and I'd lose money in the process, but not an excessively higher price.
Yeah, I mean, because you're selling covered calls, so as the stock price rebounds, let's say sharply, then the price of these calls are going to go up pretty fast. Right. So, but you're having to repay them. How do you repay them? Do you just sell stock then at that time, or do you just take more margin?
Yeah, just margin. As the margin borrowing capacity comes back because the stock's going up, then I use that margin in order to buy back the covered calls.
Okay, got it. So right now your portfolio, several days ago, you did send me screenshots of your entire portfolio, which I'm not going to share the exact amounts or anything. But yeah, it was interesting to find out that, your vast majority, it seems like it's in Tesla shares, right?
Right.
And then you have a portion, it seems like, spread out over various expiration dates, mostly out of the money calls over the next few years. But then they're kind of countered by the short cover calls that you sold in 2024, right? So it's kind of like it almost like washes out in some ways. Maybe you have more calls than you do the short, right? Is that kind of like how do you divide up your position, like what percent stock versus options that you hold?
Yeah, so I think what I was saying back in 2019 when I started, or not 2019, yeah, well, 2019, I used this 90-10 approach, was I put 90% into what I felt were lower risk type instruments, and then 10% into higher risk. I still maintain that. And as you can see, I have like 80 or 90% of my, kind of varies day by day, but 80, 90% in stock. And then I have, 5 to 20% in options, depending on how the options are doing. Last week it was a lot less in options, and this week it's a lot more in options, just because the options prices went up a lot.
Yeah, I know your stock account fluctuates radically,
Yes.
and it fluctuates even more than if you're just purely stock. And as your account has grown to, significant amounts, how do you like? Why do you think you're able to handle the volatility relatively? It seems like, as I've been kind of watching your story, you handle it relatively calmly. It doesn't seem like you're freaking out day by day. What like allows you to do that? Is there some type of perspective you have or approach that you're looking at these things?
Yeah, throughout my whole life and my career up until what, 2 or 3 years ago, I basically was just a civil engineer doing work, and yeah, I'd save some money, and I was okay, and I was perfectly happy with that. So I was, perfectly satisfied with having a home and being able to go and do things, not, excessive expenditures of money and everything, but I was happy. And so when it came time and I was investing in Tesla and made a lot of money, I had looked at it and said, okay, well, I need about maybe $4 million in order to be able to retire comfortably, and then I can basically maintain the income that I have in my retirement, which would be good. So I got to $4 million, and then I said, okay, well, I need to help out my kids, and they want to buy houses, they want to do things, so I need more money. So I did that. Got to that level and said, okay, I still have way more money now than I need or my kids need. And so what should I do with it? And then I realized that, hey, my entire career was spent making the world a better place, kind of on a small scale, basically community by community, and improving roads and improving water systems as a civil engineer, but still, making the world better. And I said, now I have the resources to, do that in a bigger way. And so I looked around and was able to find some information. First thing I did was trying to just help a few small farmers. And I realized that they really need help because they were left behind by any of the coronavirus type of programs that were out there. And soils were getting worse, and the cost of their inputs to grow things was getting worse. And so I was able to find this focus on microbiome, and the microbiome, like in your body, also exists within the soil. And so I was able to learn more about that and figured out, hey, if people can just take the soil that they have and reintroduce and nurture the bacteria and fungi that are supposed to be in the soil, that are in natural soils, that have been taken out and killed by tilling and chemical fertilizers and pesticides, then they could do well. And so I've been doing that. And so my way of getting back to your question, my way of, distancing myself or detaching myself from this is, hey, I'm fine. My kids are fine. I'm only aggressively investing in Tesla now because I want to help make the world better through healthysoilbiomes.cc. And so if it goes up, fine, I can do more. If it goes down, I can't do as much. But it's not affecting me personally. It's only affecting my ability to make the world a better place.
Got it. Yeah, makes sense. How do you look at kind of a worst case scenario? Is it possible Tesla stock drops, I don't know, let's say 90, 95%? Does it impact your own personal retirement and what you can do personally? Yeah, how do you manage kind of a possible, let's say, worst case scenario? What do you think that worst case scenario would be?
Yeah, so when I look at the worst case scenario for Tesla, and this is something that I thought of, and then Elon basically said it, is that he said it would take a meteorite hitting the Earth or World War III in order for us, not at Tesla, not to grow 50% a year, or not to grow 40% a year, that range. And so I said, okay, I agree with that because EVs are the future, and so is full self-driving, and Tesla's at the lead of that. any drop that happens within Tesla is going to be a short-term drop, and then it's going to recover. And so far, it's proved out to be the case, and that's what's happened. On the other side of it, if it does, you know, some really bad thing happens, I don't know what that would be, then I'm fine. You know, throughout my whole career, like I said, I'm a type of guy that is happy just doing things. I actually, one thing to point out is I put a certain amount of money into Tesla options initially, and that grew, you know, to huge amounts. I've actually already taken out of my Tesla account 10 times the amount that I put in. And I've used that to buy a new house. I sold, you know, one house to buy Tesla stock. I was then 6 months later able to buy a house that was much, much nicer with the margin borrowing associated with the money without selling any stock. And then I was able to help my daughter buy a house. I was able to help my son buy a house, my other son. So with all that, I'm fine even if the stock goes to zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So do you think, how do you view Elon Musk as a key man risk? Like what happens if suddenly something happens to him? Is that a concerning thing to you, or how do you assess that?
Yeah, if Elon, you know, all of a sudden gets hit by a bus, it's the kind of common saying, then, you know, the stock won't go up as much, but I think it will continue to go up. It'll be a dip and it'll drop, and then they'll continue to manufacture cars. They'll continue to sell cars. They'll continue to make things better. And it'll continue to go up. It just won't go up as much. That's the way I look at it.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Do you see like any other risks for Tesla in the next coming years? Like, what are you paying attention to? Like, if there are things that could go wrong, what would go wrong? You think possibly for Tesla in the next few years?
Yeah. Well, I look at that as challenges, and my perspective on challenges is, I think, different than most people's perspective on challenges. I remember years ago, I had a fortune cookie that basically said, the greatest pleasure in life is doing what other people say you cannot do. And not from the cannot do because it's illegal, but cannot do because you're not capable of doing it. And so I read that fortune cookie and said, that's spot on, because that's what I do in my career. I do things that people say cannot be done. I was in the city of Lincoln, and the city manager said, well, this sewer project, we put millions of dollars into it. It's not going to come to anything, but Bruce, see what you can do with it. And he basically told everybody it would never happen. I made it happen. I was able to work with the various political bodies and technical people and made it happen. So I take those things as a challenge, and I see Elon as the same kind of a person. And that's what helps me to understand what he's doing and why he's doing things, because he takes those things as a challenge. And he says, okay, you're telling me that I can't achieve, you know, the number one car manufacturer in the world. I can't have the number one car sales in the year in the world. Yeah, I can do that, and I'll do it. And he does it. He just takes it as a challenge, and then he puts things in place in order to make it happen. Did I answer your question?
yeah. Generally, I mean, you're looking at it. There's some challenges, but are there any specific challenges you think that could like become like big challenges for in the next couple of years? Like, I don't know what it might be, securing raw materials or 4680 cell ramp, or I don't know, just FSD. Do you think FSD is going to be coming out soon or not? Or
yeah, I look at those things and say, yeah, all of them have challenges. You know, the 4680, I look at the 4680 as not just the cells, but the technology associated with them that is involved in implementing them into the cars. And I say, yeah, that might not go as fast as Elon thinks it will. And same with full self-driving. Yeah, it may not go as fast as Elon thinks it will, but it'll happen. It's just a matter of how long it'll take to get there. And one thing that makes me really comfortable with the 4680 cell manufacturing is that they have this facility that's been operating for a couple of years now in Fremont, and they've scaled it up. And what they're doing now is they're simply ordering more of the production line and putting it in place in Berlin and in Texas. So it's not like they have to do a whole bunch of development to do it. They've done all the development. They're just now refining the process, getting the curve up for good cells and getting the production rate up. And so it's just a matter of time until they solve those things and have really high production. And then it's just a matter of implementing more lines and getting the raw materials. You get the raw materials, you get the lines, you're done, you go. So, so I don't see very much risk there. There is risk of delay, but I don't see a risk of failure.
Do you think they'll eventually, like, you know, tap out of demand for Model 3, Model Y? They'll have to go downstream with the cheaper car.
Yeah, they probably will eventually. When that is, I have no idea. You know, people talk about the competition, and yeah, there are lots of electric cars out there, but those electric cars are not being produced in any mass production level. They're, you know, thousands and maybe tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands a year, but not millions a year, which is what Tesla's doing. So I don't see that as real competition. You know, it's competitive in that the product maybe is somewhat competitive, but not the rate of production. And that's the key.
Yeah. I mean, why don't you think, you know, the competition, I mean, there'd be a lot of people who say, oh, the competition is ramping up though. They're investing billions of dollars. They have great new products on the horizon. And once, you know, VW and others, you know, ramp up, then Tesla, watch out Tesla, right? It's going to eat into Tesla's market share. Investors won't be as enthusiastic about Tesla as they see their market share deteriorate. Therefore, their, you know, the multiples and valuations going to go down. Like, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, VW is probably the closest to being a competitor. Right now, they are producing one car in, what is it, 30 hours, I think it is. And Tesla is producing one car in 10 hours. So that's a huge, you know, gap to overcome. And it's funny, kind of funny, because the people at VW say, well, you know, in 3 or 4 years, we'll be able to produce a car in 10 hours. Well, by that time, Tesla will be producing the car in 5 hours. And so Tesla is moving ahead quickly. And other people are trying to catch up in the future. They're trying to catch up with where Tesla is today. And that's just a recipe for failure. They just won't make it.
How much of your kind of investment thesis is based off of full self-driving, that Tesla will like increase their lead, will solve full self-driving, et cetera, versus just on more of the electric vehicle, you know, hardware business?
Yeah, you know, I don't do my own models per se, or my own, you know, cost projections. What I do is look at what other people have done, and then I make adjustments to it. And I look at it and study what they've done and say, okay, well, that seems to be light, but you know, that's a number that's huge already. And so it's big enough to take care of whatever investment I'm doing. But I think it's going to be higher than that. And it's just a matter of timing. But I think it'll be higher than almost any estimates that are out there. You know, Warren, I think Warren Redlich is probably the closest to what I think will happen. And sometimes he's a little bit higher than me, and sometimes I'm a little bit higher than he is. I see Tesla, and this is one thing that's been a little bit controversial in the past. It's been way controversial, and people thought I was really out there, saying that Tesla will reach $10,000 a share by the 2026 time period. And everybody thought I was crazy. Well, now there are more and more people that are thinking, well, that might happen. So it's getting more and more mainstream, and people are seeing that Tesla has the ability to have a share price that is extremely higher than what it is right now.
Mm. I mean, when you make when you say that, you know, 10,000 by 2026, you're saying there's a possibility. You're not saying there's like a, you're not saying it's like 95%.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I
deal with probabilities the most. And when I think of things, I think of it in probability terms. And for example, when I buy options, I try to buy options that I think are 95 to 99% certain to at least be even. And then I look at it from the standpoint of, okay, there's a 75% probability that the price could be much higher than that. And that's what I'm going for the options for. Otherwise, if I was just like, okay, I'm comfortable with this price, and that's my 99. That's the only price I'm comfortable with. I just buy stock.
Yeah.
But I see that there's a very high upside, and so that's what gets me into buying options. And yeah.
I think about a year or maybe a year ago, you were expecting 2022 for Tesla stock to be much higher, you know, than it is right now by a significant amount. Have you been surprised? And what do you think? Do you just blame, let's say, the macro environment, or is there anything you're adjusting, you know, to your Tesla kind of expectations? Yeah,
the main thing that I see happen with Tesla was that Tesla didn't anticipate the supply interruption that would happen because of COVID and the fallout from that. That's really what I see as pulling Tesla back over this last year. And it's not just a matter of not being able to get the materials, but it's a matter of them having to put so much brain power and effort into overcoming that supply chain problem that they weren't able to move other things forward fast enough. And there wasn't much of a reason to move the other things forward fast, like the Cybertruck. Why, you know, finish up the Cybertruck and get that in production when you can't build any more cars than you could have before because of the supply shortages? Mm-hmm. So I see that as probably the largest thing that impacted Tesla over this last year negatively is the supply chain fallout and challenges associated with that. Mm-hmm. The macro had an impact. But again, the macro is a short-term impact, and the supply changes are supply challenges are a short-term impact, but they have this long tail associated with them because they don't get resolved quickly. The macro stuff tends to drop way down, like with COVID, drops way down, and then all of a sudden it goes back up. And you know, war in Ukraine is the same type of thing, drops way down, goes back up.
Yeah. I think when I look at kind of Tesla's future, I think, you know, there's a few kind of bottlenecks. One is kind of the cell supply and costs. So the costs of, you know, battery cells continue, they need to go down more. And they are going down, but there's like a fundamental limit of how much they can go down every year. There's just so much innovation that needs to go in, you know, to bring down the cost of cells. Another thing is, like, it's possible if FSD gets solved, you know, that gives a huge boost of demand. But again, FSD is one of those things where it just takes so much, you know, effort to make, you know, significant progress, right, to become better than a human. So it's like hard to count on that date. And then there's like, you know, a ton of just supply challenges, like from the raw materials to, you know, hundreds of, you know, suppliers around the world. I know you're kind of really optimistic in that Tesla will be able to scale much faster than people are giving, you know, credit to Tesla for. What are your expectations in terms of like what Tesla can do in terms of scaling? Let's say, you know, in the next 3 or 4 years or so, how do you see Tesla scaling? And how do you see Tesla, do you think they can reach their 20 million vehicle a year goal in 10 years or no?
Yeah, so I look at that differently than most people look at it. I look at it from the standpoint of what is needed and what is technically possible. And then the other thing that most people are looking at is, well, what does Tesla say they're going to do? And this is one thing I learned from ARK Invest, and they look at not what the CEOs are saying or the CFOs are saying, but they look at what is technically feasible and possible and what is likely to happen in the industry, in the technology, and then they invest or they look at investments based on that. And so what I've done is looked at Tesla and said, you know, Tesla is under anticipating the demand that is going to exist for the EVs. And that's proven out in the last several quarters. You know, they see just demand for EVs and for Teslas in particular just skyrocketing, and they have no way of meeting that demand now. And they even said that in one of the quarterly reports or quarterly conference calls that they didn't anticipate this level of demand and it surprised them. Well, I see Elon taking that type of information and saying, we have this huge demand. We need to figure out how to meet, at least better meet that demand, not, you know, meet it completely, but better meet that demand. And that's, I think, what we're seeing now in the Master Plan Part 3 is where Elon's talking about massively scaling. And, you know, at the Berlin ceremony, he was talking to the employees. And one of the things he said is that, hey, we've been growing 70 to 80% a year. And I see that increasing, you know, potentially increasing going forward. And, you know, the stock market and the the people looking at the analysts looking at it, they're thinking, well, no, his 50% is way too high. We're going to put it maybe at 20%. And yet Elon's talking going from 70 to 80 to something higher than that and massively scaling production. And I think he can do it. There's no physics reason why he can't. Yeah, it's going to be hard. It's going to be challenging to scale it up that much. But I think that there's again, this is a probability thing. It's not a certain thing, but I think Tesla can be at 20 million vehicles in 2026 instead of 2030. And I look at what does it take to do that? And you look at the sites that they have now for gigafactories, and they don't need very many more sites. Yeah, sure, they need to rapidly expand what's on each one of those sites, but you could put 4 times as many buildings on the Berlin site as they have now, and you can increase the volumetric efficiency associated with that. And I think they could be up to 3 or 4 million vehicles a year out of Berlin.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll push back a little bit just because I think, for sake of discussion, I mean, with Berlin, it's been so crazy just to get one building up, it's taken over 2 years, and the permits, the demonstrations, the lawsuits. I watched this recent documentary coming out of Germany about kind of, the whole saga, and for Tesla to build just one more building on that site is going to take a lot of work.
Politically.
Yes.
Physically, but politically.
Exactly. So, I mean, this whole theoretical thing of 20 million in 2026, I mean, I think it doesn't take into consideration a lot of the practical, the realistic kind of challenges with scaling. Even Elon Musk, when he was presented at Berlin with the question, what's your best case scenario in 10 years, right? And he was saying 10 gigafactories and 20 million vehicles, right? That's what he thinks is going to be challenging, but he thinks they might be able to reach that. But I mean, if you're bringing it up, 2026 is 4 years. That's right around the corner. Elon Musk is shooting for 20, million cars, hopefully in 10 years. And, mm-hmm. It just seems like that's a big jump. I'm just saying, 6 years earlier than what Elon Musk is hoping for.
If you ask people in 2017, will Tesla be producing 1 million vehicles a year in 2021? They would have thought you're crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I actually did make those projections out, starting from 2012 and 2013, right? So I had Tesla producing millions of vehicles in the 2020s, becoming the largest, automaker. But it takes time.
But most people thought you were crazy too, right?
Yeah. They thought I was crazy, but, and there were a few people who took this more extreme side, where they're like, oh, there's gonna be no more automakers left by 2020, right? And stuff like that, right? But I had to argue against those people too, because there's a practical sense of just how things work. Where, for example, with Berlin, there's a political reality, there's a business reality, there's a supply reality, there's other companies not moving as fast as you reality. There's so many different factors that I'm just curious, I mean, that's one of the things with ARK Invest that I think has perhaps hit them hard, or has been something that has shown some weakness to their model, which is by working kind of with this theoretical what is possible approach, it works well when things are going well, but then there's these hiccups that come along. There's these unforeseen challenges. There's these business realities, and usually things to go better than expected when you have some type of mega force, like a huge network effect, like Facebook or TikTok or something that goes crazy, right? That's beyond just, and you can scale it with software too. That's not just, physical hardware and stuff. But anyways, just curious to hear, off of those points, what's your take?
Yeah, and so one of the big pushes that I see coming up, and this is not something specific that I was able to foresee, but the Russia-Ukraine conflict, that has woken up most of the people in the world now to realize we cannot be dependent upon foreign oil. We need to cut that back. How do you do that? You do it by creating more EVs. And so there's a huge spike right now in interest in EVs and demand for EVs. That's not something that anybody could have, projected. I could see it happening, but I didn't know how it was going to happen. I certainly didn't anticipate the Ukraine-Russia conflict because I didn't see any logic or any sense of why Russia would do that. They did it, but to me, it wasn't logical, but whatever, they did it. And so I think that demand, that heightened demand, is what's going to drive Tesla and what's going to make it possible for Tesla to grow rapidly. Like in Germany, I don't think they would have done the opening this last week if it wasn't for the Ukraine, Russia conflict. Because at that point in time, Germany said, hey, we need to have more EVs. I don't care if it's coming from our manufacturers or from Tesla. We need to have more EVs, and we can't be holding this project up anymore. We've got to get it going. And I think that's why it's now operating, is because of that conflict. And I see that is going to increase over time. And then the other thing, I look at it from a practical standpoint, is what's to stop, what politically will stop the development of the Berlin factory? And the biggest obstacle so far is the water. I'm a civil engineer. I've worked for years and years in water supply. There are ways of dealing with groundwater recharge and things in order to have a net zero impact on groundwater recharge. And Tesla's probably doing a lot of that right now. I saw that they built some recharge areas on their site. They could build more of those, and they can address the real, issue of the groundwater recharge. There's still going to be the political stuff and the people objecting to things, but they can address the real issue.
I'm curious, are there any other topics that you are kind of interested in talking about or discussing?
Yeah, the biggest one probably you and I talked a little bit about that, we don't want to spend too much time on, but is the healthy soil biomes that I've been working on. And one of the things that I see lots of ties between what I've done at Tesla and then the research I've done at Tesla with what we're doing with healthy soil biomes. And I remember one of your videos was about, I think, what you call it, the circle of confidence. And when I listened to that video, I realized that, wait a second, the circle of confidence for me related to Tesla is huge. Like my degree in college was transportation engineering. I did a lot of traffic engineering. Then I did civil engineering, which then fits in more with, the construction of facilities, which Tesla is doing. And so I had a good understanding of that. Then a few years ago, I was able to do a lot of research with Micron and Intel. So I had a lot of background and information associated with, the technology side of things. And then I did, options with them, and that kind of went really up and then way down, but I learned a lot from it. And at the city of Lincoln, I learned about fraud because there was a lot of fraud going on within the company. So I learned to recognize what that was. And there's just practically everything in my career fit in with building a circle of confidence associated with investing in Tesla. And then when I came to, looking at healthy soil biomes at CC, I realized that, hey, everything that I've learned at Tesla is fitting in with this. Because, for example, with Tesla, you're creating EVs, which then reduces the demand for oil, which then impacts oil companies, and so the oil companies then attack you. Well, with healthy soil biomes, you don't need to have the fertilizers that come from oil. You don't need to have the fertilizers that come from gas and the pesticides that come from those sources as well. And right now, that's a huge thing because Russia, has an impact on the sources of the oil and gas, and they have impacts on the fertilizers, and so agriculture is really being hit. And with these methods that we're using, we're relying on the nature, on the bacteria and the fungi that are in the soil that have been killed by the past practices, and regenerating those so that you don't need to have those high cost inputs, and farmers can be better off economically. The food can be a higher nutrient value, and the environment's better. We can draw down CO2 from the air and put it in the soil.
Yeah, so I was wondering about how is it possible to draw down CO2 from the air by having healthier soil?
Yeah, so an example of that is really clear in kind of prehistory. 400 million years ago, the atmosphere had like 1,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide. And mammals could not survive. It was basically an extinction event. And there weren't any people around to do mechanical devices that would take CO2 out of the air and put it in the ground someplace. Nature did it. And nature did it by the bacteria and fungi, and not just the bacteria and fungi in the soil, but also there was huge fungi that was like 10-foot tall mushroom type things. They were pulling CO2 out of the air and putting it deep in the ground. And what I kind of find ironic is that what was happening in those time periods was that CO2 was being taken out of the air and the carbon was being put in the ground. That carbon then turned into oil and gas and coal. And then man comes along and we pull those things out of the ground, we burn them and put them back in the atmosphere. And so essentially we're undoing what nature had done in multiple ways. And it's causing a big, huge problem with the earth, and we need to put it back in balance. We have 4.6 billion acres of farmland, cultivated farmland around the world, that is putting carbon dioxide into the air instead of putting it in the ground. And by changing those methods and simply using no-till farming and multi-species cover crops, we're able to put the carbon dioxide back in the ground as carbon.
So is it mostly a factor of just having like more crops or more things that go eventually back into the ground? Like let's say you compost and everything, it goes back into the ground. Is that how most of the carbon is going back through your healthy
soil biomes? That's part of it. The other part of it is that when this is fascinating that I got into this, is that the roots of plants, there are root hairs, the little tiny root hairs that go out in the ground. Those little tiny root hairs actually have bacteria and fungi that go in and out of the root hairs. And those bacteria and fungi are getting nutrients from the soil, breaking down the soil, and bringing it to the plant and putting it into the roots. They actually physically go through the root hair wall and go into the plant, deposit the nutrients, and then get out of the plant. They get carbohydrates that are made by the plant from photosynthesis. And so it's a very synergistic effect. And the way to nurture that and to expand it is to always have a living root in the ground and to always have cover over the top of the ground. And so that's where the no-till comes in. You're not tilling it. You're not destroying the roots. They're always there living. And you put multi-species cover crops on to expand the breadth of the bacteria and fungi that are in the soil. You need to have diverse bacteria and fungi.
Interesting. Yeah, man, I'm telling you, I understand kind of the core because, you know, I've been on this long health journey myself for the past maybe 10, 15 years. And it's got me through many different rabbit holes of health and nutrition. And it's kind of led to this recent kind of the past few years where I've been diving into this whole, you know, gut microbiome and the intricacies of how much like bacteria is in your gut. We're talking about trillions and trillions, so many different species, but how that is so linked to all aspects of your health, to your mental health, to your emotional stability, to so many things. And how in some people, you know, and especially with kind of this modern approach to medicine where we often have at least in the past have kind of discounted, you know, things we don't understand fully. But, you know, we've had this many decades of just this, you know, antibiotic for everything type of approach, right? And that oftentimes can wreak havoc, you know, on the variety of, you know, gut bacteria that you have. And, you know, scientists and studies are finally starting to connect the dots, you know, that how important it is. And I'm just like, I'm doing a ton of experimenting actually with my family on, you know, how much gut bacteria, like how many probiotics, different types of strains, and what we could have, what's the impact on our health, and how it could help us not just get sick, but let's say in Texas there's this big cedar allergy here in Austin. And I was doing some research and they're saying like probiotics can actually help with allergies, and so we did this big old thing where we like basically, overdose, but we took a lot of different, we ate a lot of like sauerkraut and kimchi and all these prebiotics, all this stuff for several months. And last year we were hit with cedar allergy. This year it didn't even hit us at all. We're just like completely immune to it. Our whole family, right? But we're doing all this research and I'm reading a lot of stuff, but yeah, I think it's definitely, it seems like the next frontier of health in some ways is the intricacies of, you know, the gut biome, but it has a lot of parallels with farming and soil, you know, because if you just spray Roundup and pesticides and just like, you know, have this modern, you know, one crop, you know, farming and just GMO, all this stuff, you're basically like killing, you know, the ground. Sure, it looks like it's alive by producing, you know, this one crop that's coming up, but in terms of diversity of bacteria and, you know, of life inside the soil, you basically stripped it of so much of its potential. But you're doing this thing where you're linking that now, not just to, let's say, better food and, you know, actually better nutrition for people who eat better food, but you're linking it also to climate change and, you know, bringing up capturing carbon back into our soil. So yeah, it's definitely interesting stuff.
Yeah, what analogy that I kind of figured out here recently is that with these roots and how the bacteria and fungi work to bring food to the plants, and then they take food from the plants. If you strip that away and you just provide potassium and nitrogen, you know, to the plants, it's kind of like a couch potato person. They're sitting there and they're watching TV and they have food brought to them and they just keep eating and they're just turning into a couch potato. They don't have any reason to get up and do anything because they have their food, they have the entertainment, and they just sit there and they get obese and they have problems. And the same thing happens with plants, is that if they're fed all these chemicals that they need directly, then they don't do the things that they need to in order to build an immune system. And they're not getting the nutrients that they need in order to be immune to these various problems that exist in the soil. And one of the reasons why bacteria and fungi are able to so quickly resolve health problems is because they grow fast. You know, you put a little tiny bit of that into a petri dish and it just grows. Within a few days, you have this big growth. Well, the same thing happens in your gut. The same things happen in your soil. If you have a particular bad bacteria, for example, that gets out of control, the other bacteria and fungi come in and say, hey, this is not good. We're going to eat up these bad bacteria. And they eat them. Yeah. And so it's an immune system that most people don't understand. I think and one of the things I remembered, I went down a similar path as you, looking at, you know, your health gut and, you know, what's going on within your body. And I said, and then when I found this stuff about the soil and the gut associated with the soil, I realized, well, so all we need to do is show people that, you know, the soil gut is like the, you know, your gut and your body, and then they'll, you know, go with it. And I realized that 90% or 95% of the people don't understand much about the gut in their body.
Yeah, actually,
that over to plants.
Yeah, exactly.
It's hard.
Yeah, no, it's hard. Especially when a lot of this stuff is, not completely understood scientifically. Like, there's been recent studies with, you know, gut bacteria and stuff, probiotics that actually, your gut bacteria can help you take out more nutrients from the food that you eat, but also the gut bacteria can make their own nutrients on their own, which is like completely mind-boggling in some ways, like the impact that, you know, gut bacteria can have. It's interesting, but past generations, like I think were more in touch with a lot of some of this stuff. Like, you know, if you look at a lot of different cultures, they fermented a lot of their foods, even meats and, you know, vegetables and dairy and all sorts of stuff. Like, so much of stuff was fermented that is not fermented now. Like, they've just killed the whole fermentation process, right? Even like ketchup was fermented and all this other stuff, pickles were used to. Like, nowadays, it's like, you know, you barely have, you know, much that's fermented. And it's like modern society has
even the stuff that they call fermented is a fake fermented. it's not actually fermented. They just make it seem like it's fermented, like pickles. They don't actually ferment them anymore.
Most of these add vinegar and kill everything off, you know. But yeah, it's interesting that back in the day they had that, they were more closely connected to kind of these generational principles, you know, of health that were, they couldn't explain it per se scientifically, you know, but it seems like modern society has lost a lot of that with health, but now is, I think, trying to return back to that as we have more kind of science is getting more into what it could understand, right? And hopefully we'll see a return, back to a lot of, to better health and better soil. I think better soil is like, it's connected definitely to our health.
Just a couple more stories about that. So one is I'm working with microbiologists and they've found like in soil, they found like 2,700 different bacteria and fungi in that soil. They know what 30 of them kind of do. They don't understand what the rest of them do. And so it's a matter of, first of all, we now have the technology to see that these bacteria and fungi exist in the soil, which, you know, years ago, you didn't even know that happened. And then we're learning more and more about what is happening with those. So I think that, people say this is not high tech. Well, the process is very back to nature, low tech type of a thing. But the understanding of that process is very high tech because you have to use microscopes and pretty powerful microscopes and different technologies in order to understand what's going on.
Definitely. Fascinating stuff. I'll go ahead and link to your Healthy Biomes, healthysoilbiomes.cc website. I took a look, had some great stuff on it. I'll link to your Twitter profile as well if people want to follow you. Closing up, last question, like what's the most exciting thing you look forward to from Tesla in 2022? What's something that sticks out?
Yeah, I think that to me, the most exciting things will be the scaling up of Berlin and Austin and scaling up the production of Model Y at those two facilities will be huge. And then it sounds like they're also going to be expanding in Shanghai and pretty much doubling that capacity there over a short period of time. That's the rumor. Probably is true, and they need to do it. So it's probably true one way or another. So all that scaling, I think, is going to be huge. And not just the scaling of production of vehicles, but the scaling of that 4680 tech, which will be amazing. Yeah. Well, one thing I did want to point out, and this is something that was pretty controversial when I figured it out, and I probably still is with a lot of people, but Tesla talked about how the cost of batteries at battery day, they said the cost of batteries is going to come down 52%. And the range that you get out of batteries is like 50 something percent better. Hardly anybody that I've heard of combines those two things together, because if the cost of the battery comes down and you get better range out of it, you're talking about a 70% reduction in the cost of going the same number of miles in a vehicle for batteries. You know, it's just the battery part of it. But that's a huge reduction. And most people are saying, oh, it's going to come down by 50%. I look at it and say it's going to come down by 70%. So I see that as something that we're going to see unfolding over the next year or two, is that huge reduction in the cost of batteries to get the same number of miles.
Okay, so... If that's the case, then to keep, let's say, 300 miles range, but let's say the batteries cost 50% less, but you're getting, was it about 50% more range that they said at battery day?
Yeah, it was in that. Yeah.
Then roughly. would it cost, how does that work out? Is it like a quarter then of the cost before?
Yeah, pretty much. It's 30%.
30% about, right? Yeah. Or so. From, let's say, pre-battery day costs. Of course, it takes, you know, several years to implement all the realizations.
But it's all been what, a year and a half, 2 years now since battery day? And how long ago was battery day?
Yeah. I mean, another interpretation, probably the majority, and that's what you're commenting on, is that people are saying, oh, it's 50% greater range at the same, let's say, you know, battery density or battery costs. Yeah. Do you think that's a potential interpretation, or do, are you Do you think that's the flawed? I mean, do you really think it's both combined? Like it's 50% cheaper and 50%, you're saying, more range?
Yeah, I think it's both. Yeah, which is, you know, it's Tesla does this a lot, and Elon especially. He will say things that isn't really obvious to everybody. You know, even with the master plans, he's saying it's a secret master plan. Well, he gives it to everybody, but most people don't understand it. And then if they understand it, they don't believe it. And I think it's the same type of thing with this. He said, you know, roughly 50% reduction in battery cost and a 50% range increase. And if you combine those two things, you get more like a 70% reduction in the cost of the battery for the same range.
Awesome, man. Bruce, thank you for joining. Thank you for your time. Sure. It was fun chatting and wish you the best, especially with your Healthy Soil Biomes nonprofit.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much, Dave.
All right. We'll see you.